The website of CNN has also covered this story and tells us more. Muslim U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has criticized House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California, saying Republicans don't want a Muslim woman in Congress. Kevin McCarthy, with the help of Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives, have voted to oust Ilhan Omar from her committee post over her condemnation of Israel's war crimes. Ilhan Omar hit back at Kevin McCarthy and his Republican Party, saying, "They use fear, xenophobia, Islamophobia and racism to target me." Recently, in response to questions about efforts by Kevin McCarthy to block her from continuing to sit on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Ilhan Omar said some Republicans are okay with Islamophobia. Omar said, "You remember Donald Trump coming into my state and saying Muslim Somali refugees are infiltrating our country. You remember Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene coming to Congress after Representative Rashida Tlaib and I got sworn in and saying Muslims are infiltrating Congress. You remember Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican of Colorado, saying that I was a terrorist. What did McCarthy do? He said, she apologized and we don't have to worry about her Islamophobia. That never happened." Ilhan Omar said, "And to these people are okay with Islamophobia. They're not okay with a Muslim woman which has a voice on that committee." Along with U.S. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar has triggered a widespread debate in the U.S. about Israel's crimes against Palestinians and American aid to the Israeli regime. Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, are outspoken critics of Israel's policies towards the Palestinians, and they are also vocal supporters of the Boycott, Divest and Sanctions movement, the BDS movement. The two called Israel an apartheid state guilty of war crimes. In May of 2021, Ilhan Omar condemned U.S. President Joe Biden for siding with Israel's oppressive occupation of Palestine and carrying out atrocities against Palestinians. Earlier, in April of 2019, Ilhan Omar made former U.S. President Donald Trump furious for highlighting Israel's apartheid crimes against Palestinians. The website of Press TV has also covered this story and tells us more. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry has censured this decision by the Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives to oust Democrat Ilhan Omar from a high-profile House committee. The Republican-led chamber on Thursday, 2nd of February, voted to oust the Somali-born Ilhan Omar from her seat on the influential Foreign Affairs Committee over the Muslim lawmakers' mocking of American politicians for their unwarranted support of the Israeli regime in exchange for financial rewards. In reaction to the highly politicized move, Nasser Kanani, a spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, said, "Boycotting a critic of the Israeli apartheid regime depicts the United States' parliamentary tyranny." Referring to the key slogan behind the recent Western-backed riots across Iran, Kanani tweeted, "Ousting Ilhan Omar, black Muslim and critical of Israeli apartheid, from a House committee indicates practical commitment of the United States to the motto of woman, life, freedom." The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry added, "The U.S. resorted to the slogan as a means of interfering in Iran's internal affairs."
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we bring news of an unreported scandal about the UK's Ministry of Defence. Our investigations indicate that the MOD has been infiltrated by a tech company which openly supports the Zionist entity. We'll be discussing the modus operandi of Oracle, the world's largest database company, and its billionaire owner, Larry Ellison, after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra.
The British Ministry of Defence and Home Office are compromised. The data gathered by these institutions is handled directly by a company that explicitly defines itself as pro-Israel. This is the story of how a Zionist billionaire who funds the Israeli military, along with his IT company, is able to access the most sensitive data regarding British security. The Oracle company was founded by Larry Ellison in 1977. The firm adopted the name of a CIA operation, and the first service it provided was helping the intelligence agency build a database. Oracle later hired David Carney to head its Information Assurance Center. Carney had previously been the third highest ranked employee at the CIA, where he worked for 32 years. Today, Oracle is the world's second biggest IT software company, and Larry Ellison is the seventh richest person in the world. He is still the top shareholder in Oracle and works as the chief technology officer, as well as sitting as the executive chairman of the company, despite passing the role of CEO to Israeli Safra Katz. To shut down a protest against the NATO summit in 2012, the US police used Oracle software called Indeca Information Discovery. The mechanism was able to merge criminal records with protesters' tweets, thus providing a more effective database of targets for surveillance. Larry Ellison was also instrumental in Elon Musk's bid to take over Twitter, providing the longtime collaborator with the security state with $1 billion to pursue his takeover. Less well known is the closeness of Ellison and, in fact, the whole company to Israel. In 2007, Ellison gave $500,000 directly to the Israeli settlement of Sderot. Over a period of a decade, he donated over $26 million to the Israeli military through the funding vehicle, the Friends of the Israeli Occupation Forces. The current CEO of Oracle has explicitly stated the company's pro-Israel bias. Safra Katz exclaimed, "We are not flexible regarding our mission, and our commitment to Israel is second to none. If our employees don't agree with our mission to support the state of Israel, then maybe we aren't the right company for them. Larry and I are publicly committed to Israel." The extent of the company's relationship with Israel is even more clearly seen in the report that Ellison even offered the current Israeli Prime Minister, the fascist Benjamin Netanyahu, the position of director at Oracle. How can the data of the British Ministry of Defence and the Home Office be considered safe in these hands?
As ever, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, as well as being a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He also co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Huda Amori. Huda is a UK-based Palestinian activist who co-founded the groundbreaking Palestine Action Group that's leading the way in radicalising the pro-Palestine movement. And we spoke to her earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, the film suggests the British MOD and Home Office are compromised. I mean, this seems like a story with some kind of corruption involved. I mean, is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Well, it certainly does look that way. It looks like that this guy, Ellison, one of the richest guys in the world, with one of the biggest database companies in the world, has pumped millions of pounds into a foundation in this country with what looks like the purpose of gaining contracts with the Ministry of Defence. Now, that, if it was true, would be bribery. I mean, it would be against the law. But there's something very, very odd about this, which is that he has been using his philanthropy like this for some considerable time. And it's a company which is avowedly pro-Israel, and yet it's being allowed into the Ministry of Defence's data to collect the Ministry of Defence's data, including, you know, a contract of up to £2 billion a year. So it's not just £2 billion altogether. £2 billion a year for this contract. This is a huge contract where the military are giving away their data effectively to an organisation which says it's pro-Israel. Now, that seems to me, on the face of it, to be problematic.
Well, we asked Huda for her reaction to the MOD and Home Office allowing their data to be stored by an organisation that's so explicitly pro-Israel.
I'm disgusted to find out that the Home Office and the Ministry of Defence are using software by a company called Oracle, whose founder, Larry Ellison, invests in the Israeli military and in Israeli settlements built on the rubble of Palestinian homes. The fact that our data, our information, is being handed over to a company whose loyalty and interest lie with a foreign apartheid state is a national security risk to all of us. The irony of it coming from the Home Office, whose predecessor, Priti Patel, was the one who sponsored the National Security Bill. A National Security Bill which included clauses in order to try and deter people from taking action to disrupt arms companies, whilst at the same time handing over our data to a company whose interests lie with a foreign apartheid state.
David, Latifah's report said Larry Ellison has even provided substantial sums of money to the illegal settlement of Sidrat near Gaza. I mean, this guy doesn't seem to have any regard for international law, does he?
Well, no, I mean, he's a paid-up Zionist. He gave a huge amount of money to the settlement. And you can see on the screen here the people from that settlement sitting on the hilltop overlooking Gaza as the IDF pulverises the people of Gaza with bombs. And these are the people who are being given the money by this guy, Ellison. It's an absolute travesty.
Indeed. It's almost like a spectator sport. It's absolutely outrageous. Well, Huda then told us about Palestine Action's latest victory with the Ministry of Defence vis-à-vis Israel.
At the end of last year, Palestine Action found out that the Ministry of Defence was booting Elbit out of contracts worth over £280 million. Their reasoning behind this was because they were revising operational sovereignty standards for their highest capabilities. This is in the context of several activists in Palestine Action breaking in and breaching security at Elbit sites in order to stop the weapons that they make from being built to be used to kill Palestinians and others across the world. This made Elbit an unreliable partner for the Ministry of Defence. But at the same time, they're still relying on companies who have an affinity to the Israeli state for our information, our data.
David, what do you say about Larry Ellison's huge donations to the Friends of the IDF?
So Friends of the IDF is a US-based organisation which exists to channel funds to the Zionist entities, military forces. There's a similar UK organisation called the UK Friends of the Association for the Wellbeing of Israel Soldiers. And Ellison gave a huge donation to them, $10 million back, way back in, I think, 2010. And then a few years later, he gave another huge donation of $16 or $17 million. Wow. So that's what we know about so far. That's $26 million to this organisation, which simply channels it towards an organisation which is knee-deep in ethnic cleansing, in human rights violations, and indeed, in this, as you know, the assassination almost daily of Palestinians in the West Bank and indeed in Gaza. So this is an indication of the kind of politics of this guy who has a contract, this massive contract, with the Ministry of Defence. Doesn't anyone in this country think that's a bit odd?
It certainly is odd, and you'd think there would be more questions, or some questions at least, being asked about it. But we also asked Huda then what the phrase operational sovereignty actually means and whether she thought it has any relevance to this case with Oracle.
Operational sovereignty is the language they used when they were kicking Elbit out of these contracts, Elbit Systems, who are Israel's largest arms firm. Operational sovereignty basically, in my opinion, means that they need to protect their programs which involve a high level of security risk to them in order to protect the interests of the sovereign British state. And obviously, working with a company, an Israeli arms company, no longer fits that term for the Ministry of Defence. But at the same time, now they're openly using all of our data and giving it to a company whose interests lie in a foreign state. So how can we talk about operational sovereignty in one sense, and then hand over the information of British citizens to those who favour an apartheid state, who colonise the Palestinian people and assist in the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people?
David, in Latifah Abouchakra's report, she said Larry Ellison was instrumental in Elon Musk's bid to take over Twitter. I mean, can you say any more about that?
Well, it seems he was. I mean, he, being a billionaire, he has a spare $1 billion in his back pocket, and he gave his mate Elon Musk $1 billion for the deal. And Musk was, if you look at the press coverage, texting him intensively during the whole process. Now, if you remember, we did a program previously about Elon Musk.
Yes.
And we looked in particular at one of the other brokers of the deal, this guy called Ari Emanuel, whose dad was in the Ergon and was a gunrunner for the Ergon. It seems that Musk surrounds himself with people who are, you know, really quite hard-line Zionists. And yet we are thinking that he might be someone who supports free speech. Well, he's not going to support free speech on Palestine with backers like that. And that's an indication of the milieu in which Elon Musk works, as well as getting money from the military-industrial complex. He's very heavily implicated in pro-Zionist forces.
Mm. Well, that's certainly very interesting to rich people using their money for nefarious purposes there. But we're just going to pause the discussion for a moment now. Another report on Larry Ellison's use of a charitable foundation in his UK operations.
When Oracle obtained the contract to carry out cloud services for the digital defence programme in the British Ministry of Defence, and it took over a £2 billion budget and a team of around 2,400 personnel in September 2020, it was clear that the amount of data held by the company would be immense. New information about the associations of Oracle founder Larry Ellison could bring into question the means through which this contract was awarded. In the years leading up to his company, Oracle, being awarded this role with the Ministry of Defence, Larry Ellison's foundation employed several well-placed figures within the British establishment, including members of the British Prime Minister's own family. Ellison employed Matthew Symonds, the father-in-law of then Prime Minister Boris Johnson, as an executive director, earning £500,000 a year and supposedly working 40 hours a week for the Ellison Foundation. Another figure Ellison paid £500,000 a year to is Richard Meredith. In his role as Deputy Executive Director, Meredith was previously the Director of Communications for British National Security in the Foreign Office. He also worked in the Cabinet Office, clearly a well-connected man. Also employed by Ellison was Fabian Chessel as a strategy executive, taking home almost £200,000. After leaving the foundation, Chessel went directly into a job as policy advisor to the Foreign Secretary at the time the Oracle contract was awarded. He then went on to be an advisor to the Deputy Prime Minister and Chancellor, where he claimed to have reviewed a $1 billion IT transformation program. Did that IT transformation include the one his former boss directly benefited from? Ellison's charity also employed Vel Ganandran, who had worked for the British government for 15 years, including at the Cabinet Office. He worked for the Foreign Office at the time the contract was awarded to Oracle. The Larry Ellison Foundation also paid consulting fees to the ominous Control Risk Group. The private intelligence firm features many former British military figures and highly placed political movers and shakers. The most interesting consulting group Ellison paid was World First UK, which earned £300,000 in 1 year. The business is based at 21 to 24 Milbank Tower in central London. That just happens to be next door to the Conservative Party campaign headquarters, which is at 30 Milbank Tower. The CEO of World First UK, Jonathan Quinn, is so close to the British government that he travelled to China with the then Prime Minister Theresa May in 2018. The Larry Ellison Foundation heaped tens of millions of pounds upon the Tony Blair Foundation, along with millions on Friends of Israel initiatives. This fascinating thing about this story is that as soon as the Oracle contract with the Ministry of Defence was acquired, Larry Ellison closed down his foundation, which employed all of these suspicious figures. However, the Oracle contract was obtained in the Ministry of Defence and the Home Office. It is clear Ellison has gone to great lengths to get close to circles of power in Britain.
David, is there any evidence to suggest that British or Israeli intelligence agencies are implicated in this story in any way?
Well, it's very curious. There's a guy in there who mentioned in the film, a guy called Meredith, who appears to have been close to MI6, possibly in MI6 when he was in the Foreign Office in the National Security area. But he also previously had worked in Brunswick, the kind of pucker blue chip PR firm in London. Amongst his clients there were the Offer family. The Offer family, of course, the shipping magnates who worked closely with Mossad in sending ships into Iran with Mossad teams on board. He now works for another organisation which is also close to the Offer family. So we're seeing there connections potentially with both Israeli intelligence and with MI6. Now, both of those questions raise questions. So why on earth would someone who might have such connections be employed by Larry Ellison at £500,000 salary on a foundation to give money on ageing research, nowhere near any of his apparent expertise? So there's something very odd about that, and it looks to me like there's some kind of connections. We don't know what those connections are, but it's the kind of thing which an inquiry really ought to sort out.
Curiouser. We asked Huda about the relationship between the Israeli government and the British police.
The Israeli police, the Israeli government and the British police, we know, have a close relationship. We know this because last year, in May 2022, there was a meeting between the Hackney police and the Israeli police. Now, this was tweeted out by the Hackney police, who openly stated that this was happening, and it was met with a lot of outrage. I found it strange, personally, that they even admitted to it, because we know these things happen often behind closed doors.
David, I wonder whether you could tell us a bit more about the role of Matthew Simmons in this story.
Well, Matthew Simmons is, of course, Carrie Simmons' dad, the wife of the former Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. And he, again, was paid £500,000 for this role. Now, his background is as a journalist. He, not coincidentally perhaps, wrote this book back in 2004. Yes. So a long time before he got the £500,000 job, he was writing this book about Larry Ellison. Now, this was not a critical account, as you can tell from the fact that Larry Ellison himself contributed part of the foreword to the book. So there's some kind of relationship there. He's an expert, he's a journalist, he's written about these issues, written about technology issues, but that's nothing to do with what the foundation was allegedly doing, which was allegedly funding ageing research. So there's something very curious there that again, seems to cry out for some kind of inquiry.
Indeed it does. Well, we also asked Huda about how she felt as a Palestinian about her data being handled by an explicitly pro-Israel company.
As a Palestinian, knowing that whilst living in this country, whilst many of us live in exile, who have been forced out of our homes in Palestine by the Israeli occupier, and are living in a country now like Britain, that our information here is being handed over to our oppressors, to our occupiers, and the ones who forced us out in the first place. How are we ever supposed to trust this state when they work so openly with the Israeli state? The complicity is damning. And we know that Britain has been complicit in the colonisation of Palestine for over 100 years, going back to the Balfour Declaration.
David, Larry Ellison has a history of dubious involvement in philanthropy, doesn't he?
Well, he is someone who signed up to one of these pledges that people like Bill Gates suggested people should do, where they signed up to a pledge to give away at least half of their fortune within their lifetime or in their will when they die. And Ellison has signed up to that. He's even said that he will give away more than half of his fortune. But he's not really been able to do that. He's been singularly unsuccessful in giving away money. So on two separate occasions prior to this incident with the Ministry of Defence, he's said that he's going to give money away, and then at the last minute he said, oh, well, actually, I'm not going to do that. For example, he said he was going to give a huge sum of money to either Stanford or Harvard universities. He made them compete for the money. At the time that two people at Stanford were on a committee deciding whether he was corrupt or not, he decided in the end, once he'd found him not guilty, to give the money to Harvard. And then he didn't even give the money to Harvard either. So he has a history of pulling out of philanthropic activities. And it certainly seems that he's not going to go anywhere near giving serious amounts of money to philanthropic causes that he said he will do. So this is a pattern of behaviour which only makes the whole question about the Ministry of Defence and whether it's been played here more pertinent.
Mm. Well, look, as well as the issue of corruption in this story, is there not a question about British national security? Is that at stake in this issue as well, do you think?
We have done reports in this programme on this kind of issue on a number of occasions. Before I started doing this programme, when I was an academic, I had no idea that there were these kinds of conflicts of interest right at the top of British society. But we uncovered example after example. We previously looked at British Telecom and the Zionist billionaire there who was being investigated, actually, on national security grounds for his takeover of British Telecom, which is critical national infrastructure. If British Telecom is regarded as critical national infrastructure, it seems to me very unlikely that the Ministry of Defence's data would not also be so regarded. And we have here a guy whose company says explicitly, we're a pro-Israel company, and people who are not pro-Israel are not welcome to work here. So we have clearly a potential national security issue. When you add in the question of the potential role of Mossad, of MI6, what on earth are MI6 doing? Are they incompetent, or have they actually used an agent to follow through this process and are involved in it in some way? It really does beg a belief that an organisation like MI6, which is supposed to defend British national interests, can be either blindsided by this or collaborating in something which clearly is a problematic thing for British national interests.
Mm. How do you account for the fact that it only seems to be Palestine Declassified that is actually investigating these issues and highlighting them?
Well, I suppose I would say I'm surprised, but you know, there is nowhere in the mainstream which will look at these issues, even these issues when it's not to do with Palestine. When it's to do with Palestine, that's, you know, it's way out of the ballpark. You can't possibly deal with these issues because you'll be bullied and intimidated and you'll be called anti-Semitic and you'll be said to be attacking Israel only because you have this secret hatred of the Jews and all the stuff which they will throw at you. But these are genuine issues. And I may have mentioned this before, but, you know, my research has shown that way back in the 1950s, MI5 uncovered an Israeli spy inside the National Security Council of the UK. They quietly sacked the guy and moved him out of the way. And they said in their files, which have now been declassified, we understand that the State of Israel is a hostile foreign power. Mm. And things have not changed in all the years since then. And we still have the State of Israel trying to penetrate British society. This is one example that we've been looking at in the Ministry of Defence. There are many, many others. And it's about time the British security establishment woke up and smelled the coffee. Mm. This is something which they need to focus on.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time again today. I want to thank our guests, Huda Mori, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. You won't find the corporate media shining a light into the murky corners of the Zionist lobby like we do. And we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the Limelight.
Reports say a proposed bill in the U.S. state of New England would see prisoners trade their organs for a reduced sentence. This shameful and controversial bill is another step in America's descent into a horror story of late-stage capitalism that one might dub vampiric and where the wealthy feed on the blood of the poor. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to the website of RT, state legislatures around the United States are keenly watching the fate of a Massachusetts bill allowing prisoners to receive up to 1 year off their jail sentence by donating their organs. According to reports, Bill H.D. 3822, called the Act to Establish the Massachusetts Incarcerated Individual Bone Marrow and Organ Donation Program, would allow participating prisoners to receive a minimum of 60 days and up to a whole year of their sentence. It would be set up in a special parole hearing based similarly on commuted sentences for good behavior. However, it would also encourage repeat donations, and since those incarcerated in the U.S. are disproportionately minorities and low-income earners, it bears similarities to the country's blood and plasma donation scheme. That system preys on low-income earners and students, encouraging them to consistently donate their blood at for-profit collection centers, effectively selling it in a sort of vampiric version of capitalism. In a 2019 piece titled Harvesting the Blood of America's Poor, the Latest Stage of Capitalism, Alan McLeod observed that around 130 million Americans admit an inability to pay for basic needs like food, housing, or healthcare. Buying and selling blood is one of the few booming industries America has left. The number of collection centers in the United States has more than doubled since 2005, and blood now makes up well over 2% of total U.S. exports by value. To put that in perspective, Americans' blood is now worth more than all exported corn or soy products that cover vast areas of the country's heartland, he said. According to McLeod, the U.S. supplies fully 70% of the world's plasma, mainly because most other countries have banned the practice on ethical and medical grounds. Exports increased by over 13% to $28.6 billion between 2016 and 2017, and the plasma market is projected to grow radiantly, according to one industry report. The majority goes to wealthy European countries. Germany, for example, buys 15% of all U.S. blood exports. Other countries like Japan are also key customers. But low-incomers giving blood for money is a very different scenario from prisoners literally giving their organs for freedom. The most important difference is that the proposed organ donations by prisoners would be the result of a criminal penalty. The U.S. Constitution prohibits cruel and unusual punishment of convicts, and one could argue this makes the bill unconstitutional. But the way it is framed means the organ for freedom contract is not technically a punishment, but simply a voluntary system that can reduce a convict's actual punishment. Neither is it necessarily cruel, since a person can live a normal everyday life without a kidney, nor unusual because healthy people donate organs all the time. The United States has slavery as a form of punishment codified in its constitution via the 13th Amendment. It is also a country where the death penalty is legal at the federal level, but mainly implemented by states in capital offenses such as murder. U.S. prisons also routinely implement long-term solitary confinement, recognized by the UN as a form of torture. The threshold to prove cruel and unusual punishment is thus exceptionally high. One of the primary arguments put forward by proponents of the bill is that prisoners have no way, as of now, to donate organs even if they choose to. That is a pretty sound case. After all, shouldn't they be able to exercise that right if everyone else has it? And what's the argument against them losing this right, especially if it helps everyone, including Massachusetts' jammed up donor waiting list? Unfortunately, the easily foreseen problem is that it incentivizes people to literally give up organs, parts of their bodies, for their freedom. This is inherently immoral. The people locked up in U.S. prisons are disproportionately from minority groups, subject to awful conditions, with little access to economic aid or rehabilitation. This is one of the main reasons why the U.S. has the highest recidivism rate in the world, with 76% of prisoners released being rearrested within 5 years, and an astonishing 44% returning to prison within only 1 year. The entire system is set up for failure and for people to return to prison, thus pushing them to donate their organs, but without any financial compensation, only a reduced sentence.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iranian foreign policy with Deputy Foreign Minister Dr. Ali Bagheri Kani. But first, this brief analysis.
As we enter 2023, the rapidly emerging new multipolar world and the historic failure of the JCPOA process are two realities that are significantly affecting Iranian foreign policy. At the same time, Iran's ever-increasing hard and soft power, rooted in the efforts and jihad of its own population, are enhancing Iran's power and strategic options in this emerging new world. Even though international organizations such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or BRICS, have existed for many years, it's the addition of the Islamic Republic of Iran to these organizations that many analysts consider to be an important sign of this new emerging multipolar world and the end of U.S. global hegemony. There was a time in the beginning of the 21st century when the US and Europe believed they could create regime change in countries like Iran and Russia, install strategically compliant governments in these countries, and in this way, neutralize these two Eurasian powers as potential rivals. But these attempts failed on numerous occasions, and we are now witnessing a world order emerging, wherein Iran is joining international fora such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS, even after the failed JCPOA process proved that Western economic sanctions against Iran will never be lifted as agreed to by the US and EU, though Iran has complied fully with its commitments. The US will never allow countries such as Iran, Russia, or China to rise and develop peacefully unless they accept becoming its strategic and economic vassals. The world and Iran itself has changed significantly in recent years, making obsolete the assumptions of the late 20th century that Iran needs to have some sort of sanctions relief from the West in order to grow its economy. Iran is experiencing significant economic growth for the first time since the global COVID outbreak. It is selling millions of barrels of oil on a daily basis, and according to the IMF, is now the largest economy in West Asia, slightly larger in size than the Australian economy, ahead of Saudi Arabia, and twice as large as Turkey's economy based on GDP purchasing power parity. All this while still being sanctioned by the US and Europe to a greater degree than when the JCPOA process began so many years ago. The world will experience significant political, security, economic, and technological change in the decade ahead, and it will be characterized by America's desperate and violent attempts to maintain whatever it can of its rapidly declining hegemony. All of these factors will significantly affect all countries, including Iran. But unlike some other countries, Iran will use these new circumstances to increase its fundamental goal of maintaining strategic independence and continuously increasing its hard and soft power as it has in the last 40 plus years. Iran's most important power is its message and its manifest example of not being an oppressive power on the world stage and never accepting oppression from other powers. A message and power rooted in the Islam of the Ahlul Bayt, and something very appealing to all liberated human beings from all corners of the world. Iran's successful model of very significant independent social growth and development, while resisting US hegemony, serves as the model for many countries as they seek to find their place in the new emerging world order. A soft power that Iran attained through decades of sacrifice and jihad of its people. A power that very few others in the world can lay claim to.
Deputy Foreign Minister, Dr. Bagheri Kenny, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. I know your schedule is very busy. You've taken the time to come sit with us and talk about these issues. Thank you so much. And this is a good opportunity for us to discuss issues related to Iran's foreign policy. Of course, you're in the middle of all these events, so your analysis, your evaluations, your opinions are highly valued in this regard. And I would like to, with your permission, begin our discussion with this idea, this concept that's been mentioned a lot recently by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, by various experts from around the world, this idea that we are entering into a new global order, that the old order with American unipolarity, with American hegemony, is coming to an end, that we're moving towards multipolarity, that there are different countries and powers in the world who will now have the capability of exerting their power and their influence in the world in a way that was not the case previously. So if you could please give us your analysis, your evaluation, your understanding of this idea that we are now entering into a new global order.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of God, I send greetings, and I hope that this program, within the framework of the main mission of the media to explain different points of view, can be transparent, direct, and successful, and be a platform for the elucidation of developments and phenomena, so that everyone can be realistic and even with different perspectives, be able to realistically see the path ahead and make smart and conscious choices. In response to your question, I would suggest that order is always based on a balance. After World War II, the victorious states in the war created a balance by themselves. Although they wielded dissimilar levels of power, a balance was created between them, and an order was established based on this tacit agreement between them within the framework of the understanding between them, leading to the formation of comprehensive and political mechanisms such as the United Nations and the Security Council with the veto power of these countries. Also, due to the advantages of the Americans exercised in various fields, especially in the economy, mechanisms such as the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund were set up in the global arena. But the role and influence that the Western countries, especially the Americans, had in these mechanisms was much more significant compared to others. In my opinion, the important point on which this order was based was the issue of the power of the parties that formed this order. Because the nature of their power was based on their military capabilities that had come to the fore during the war, and later they gradually became nuclear powers, and after the Americans, the others gradually became nuclear powers, and particularly these five countries became the five nuclear powers that could create a very serious and effective deterrence, they were the ones that formed that power. But over time, both the internal changes made by these powers as well as the environmental transformations witnessed in global developments underline this order to the extent that after the collapse of the former Soviet Union, one could say that the order was shaken, like it was hit by an earthquake. Because finally, a superpower that had stood against the Western world as the Soviet Union, with all its dimensions of territorial prowess and geographical power given its control over a vast territory right into the heart of Europe, not to mention other elements of power, was practically put aside, despite all the power it exercised, and a new world was born. Other environmental developments were also effective. Issues such as the Persian Gulf War and Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in the wake of that Persian Gulf War also plays a role in these transformations. At that time, the Americans claimed a unipolar system in the world. Perhaps, according to many experts and theorists, this claim was not an exaggerated one because of the power gap between the U.S. and the rest of the world, which was a significant gap in various respects, economically, scientifically, politically, in the media, militarily, you name it. Well, the Americans had the belief that they could shape this order based on their own centrality. Actually, they exerted a lot of effort to this end. But since there is little time, I won't take the time to talk about this. But another thing happened along this path, and that was the Islamic Revolution. Although the Islamic Revolution took place in a country in the West Asian region, the content and quality dimensions of the Islamic Revolution presented a new way of thinking and a new model in the design of the international system, and that was not relying on any major powers. This was a limited framework within the framework of the Islamic Revolution. Confronting the Islamic Revolution was very seriously and effectively pursued from the very beginning by various powers, especially the Western ones. And the 8-year war imposed on the Iranian nation by Saddam took place within the same framework. After some time, the Americans themselves realized that although this order is their wish and expectation, the regional and international conditions do not allow it to proceed as smoothly as they had wished it to proceed, because many of the elements of their power were challenged in important areas of the world. The Islamic Revolution brought a serious challenge to the main power pillars of the Americans in our region, which is the Zionist aggressor and occupying regime. This regime, which always, after its illegitimate birth, which has always desired expansion and did this in practice, encroached on other lands and occupied them. It would not even respect international mechanisms, but it was forced to withdraw from Lebanon for the first time. And the essence of the will that caused the Zionists to surrender, its source was the Islamic Revolution. And the whole world understood that such a power has been formed here. The vast international support that was given, even to Israel's crimes, would not keep this regime safe in that framework, and they had to retreat in many areas. Later, they retreated from Gaza. In any case, this framework had been disrupted, Americans' frame of mind for a unipolar global order. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were small tests and trials to determine what the framework of the international order would be like. Even if you remember, some people in Russia, like Yeltsin and his companions, expressed their desire to join the Western Bloc, and even expressed their desire to join NATO. But none of that worked. It remained as an expression of desire or an outward and verbal welcome. The important point was that two important changes occurred in the international arena. One was the decline of the power elements of the Western world, especially the U.S. When you look at this issue from a futures perspective, you can see that this decline is becoming very tangible. I recently saw in an assessment by an American institution that, for example, by the year 2050, the world's first and second economies are not expected to be the U.S. The first and second in the world will be two Asian countries, China and India. The third will be the U.S. There will be a root cause and background for this to be materialized by 2050. That background is that which we are talking about. So this decline is an objective reality. A similar issue happened in Europe. The blow given by Trump to the cohesion and connection of the two sides of the Atlantic, the discussions that were held for them to contribute their share in NATO and so on, this created a gap in the Western world, and this matter was effective in the strategic weakening of the elements of Western power. But an issue that was and still is an important matter for the Western world, especially the United States, is the question of Russia's independence-oriented power. After the collapse, they had a plan to limit this power or to employ it within their own framework. One side is the Western view. On the opposite side, in any case, the powers that have both civilizational and historical roots and are emerging powers in today's terms. In many countries, it cannot be said that they are emerging powers. You may suppose that South Africa is an example of an emerging power, but after all, Russia is a power with a historical background. Or take China, for example. It is a power that has the elements of history. It is not like they achieved a power structure overnight or at one point very quickly. The point that these powers arrived at is that in order to secure their own interests in the foreseeable future, they must create their own distance from the Western world in a meaningful way, that is, seek independence. Accordingly, they looked for new power mechanisms. They realized that multilateralism cannot be realized in the framework of the UN Security Council or the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or other mechanisms. My understanding is that the creation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or BRICS, which later developed into BRICS Plus, emerged from this mindset. We should create powerful international multilateral mechanisms to prevent the monopoly and bullying and domineering of Westerners, especially the Americans, without causing the collapse of existing mechanisms by using the capacity of these international authorities. For this reason, you can see, for example, that the elements of power that exist now in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or BRICS Plus, have caused them to match up with new players in a new fashion. After a predictable period of time, I imagine that they can see themselves as an element of power that the Western side, especially the Americans, should pay serious attention to. Perhaps one of the reasons we can posit as the root cause of the war in Ukraine is this issue, which can create a divide between this multilateralism against the Western world and weaken it. And both the creation of disunity and its weakness are in favor of the continuation of the management model that was developed by the Westerners after World War II and persists even today. In any case, they are looking to develop and improve these elements of power based on the axes that are at their disposal within the framework of their interests. So we're now faced with a world that is in transition and must reach a new order. Because after all, it is correct that the world has gone through various orders in the past. Every balance comes to an order. But this order may be an unstable one because we believe that based on our religious teachings, an order can only be stable and bring peace, prosperity, and happiness to mankind only if it is based on justice. But this does not mean that other orders are not formed. Other orders can be formed. For example, suppose someone steals from someone else. For a while, he will benefit from what he has stolen. He may steal some money from someone, get himself something to eat, buy a piece of land, but this will not be sustainable. After all, there are factors that repair or correct that violation. Based on this, we will reach an order, a new order, but it will not necessarily be a justice-oriented. But one of the important elements that we can now discern as the outlook of multilateralism in the world for this new order is the justice-oriented approach. Now, how much it will be realized is another matter to discuss. For example, in our dealings with the Chinese and the Russians, we see that they hold a similar approach in their take on this new order. They always stress a justice-oriented order based on the views, ideas, and power of independent countries. Such an approach creates a stable backbone for the new order. But allow me to emphasize once again, how much this has been achieved in practice is debatable because it depends on many other factors. What we say is this: we have a transition period to reach a new order, and one side is the Western world led by the U.S., and on the other side is multilateralism centered on several countries with different elements of economic, demographic, military, scientific, and media power, such as Russia, China, Brazil, South Africa, Iran, and India. These countries are striving to coordinate between themselves so that they can present the elements of their national powers in the world arena with synergy. Because the elements of power, if they fail to work together, will not be able to withstand the existing order imposed by the West and disrupt this imposed order so that we enter the stage of establishing a new world order. At this stage, I think that the Islamic Republic of Iran has played a prominent role and can even be a more decisive player in the future in several ways. One of them is from the Islamic Republic of Iran's approach and insight. The Islamic Republic of Iran's approach, which is based on the Islamic Revolution mindset, is people-centered. The governance model it has presented is religious democracy. I think this is a very important point. We see people-centeredness in all manifestations and matters of the view of the Islamic Revolution, whether inside the Islamic Republic or outside. For example, the element of resistance that manifests the regional view of the Islamic Republic of Iran is basically people-based. It means that it is the people who can shape this, direct it, continue, and improve it. In parentheses, it should be noted that the art of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic is that this view, especially the model of resistance, which is based on the people, is not in opposition to the governments. Rather, it is synergistic with governments, except in Palestine, where we believe that the Zionist regime is an aggressor and the resistance current is rightly against this regime. But in other places, you can see that the resistance movement is helpful to and synergistic with the government. And this, in my opinion, is one of the secrets of the success of the Islamic Republic model. Because the Western side and the foreigners cannot create a distance between the government and the popular movement of resistance, trying to represent resistance as an illegitimate current. Look, for example, how Hezbollah is operating in Lebanon. What is Jaish al-Shaabi in Syria? What are the Popular Mobilization Forces, PMF, doing in Iraq? But the point is that it has created a new element of power. The effort that the Western world is making, if you take time to pay attention, you will see that these popular elements of power are aimed at providing national interests for these countries and help governments to ensure national security, preserve territorial integrity, and ensure the well-being and comfort of the people. In order to weaken them, because they cannot destroy them, they label them as terrorist movements. They give these groups a negative international image to prevent them from promoting their current state of power. So, what were we discussing?